This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Kathy Constable. I'm the acting director of Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and I'm also a professor of geophysics here. So it's great to see everybody here. I'm very glad you could all join us, and I want to take this opportunity to welcome you to this evening's show. We've got some interesting instruments out there. It's going to be a fascinating look into Scripps research and the recent work that some of our folk have been doing in the deep sea, really pioneering work. And now I'm going to turn this podium over to Betsy McKibben, who is the EW Scripps Associates Steering Committee Chair. Betsy?
Good evening. As Kathy said, my name is Betsy McKibben, and I have the pleasure of being the chairman of the EW Scripps Steering Committee. EW Scripps Associates is a group of annual donors for Scripps Institution of Oceanography. The Steering Committee determines what areas of Scripps these unrestricted funds raised by our members go to. Now, getting down to business, our first speaker is Alexis Pasulka. During a recent oceanographic expedition off San Diego, graduate student researchers from Scripps Institution of Oceanography discovered convincing evidence of a deep sea site where methane is seeping out of the seafloor, the first such finding off San Diego County. Alexis Pasulka, a six-year PhD student in the Biological Oceanography Program at SIO, will share more about their discovery. Alexa?
Thank you so much. This evening, I'm going to tell you a tale of discovery right here off the coast of San Diego. I'll share a little bit about the deep sea ecosystem we found in our own backyard. But this is really a tale of what you can do with a big ship, a group of motivated graduate students, and some good clues. As some of you may have heard, we recently discovered a methane seep off the coast of San Diego. But before I tell you about our discovery, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about these types of environments, what a chemosynthetic environment is, and why it's important to study. Then I'll tell you how we went about finding our methane seep, and what we're doing now back here at Scripps with our samples. All, of course, in a few short minutes. Just to give you a sneak peek, these are some pictures of chemosynthetic environments that some of my colleagues and I have studied from other places around the world. And just from glancing at them, you may be able to glean that these are environments that are full of life and color, which is in contrast to what a lot of us think about when we imagine what the bottom of the ocean looks like. I think the easiest way to explain a chemosynthetic environment is to contrast it with an environment we're all a little more familiar with. A photosynthetic environment. So here on land or in the surface of the oceans, plants use energy from the sun along with carbon dioxide and water to make sugars, things that you and I and other animals can then eat. In these environments, the base of the food web is plants who make the energy using sunlight. But down in the bottom of the ocean, where there is no sunlight, some microorganisms have adapted other strategies to find energy or to make energy. In some places of the seafloor, particularly along the edges of continents, like right here off the coast of San Diego, you find methane deep below the seafloor. And this methane can actually seep up through faults and fractures. And as it nears the surface layers of the sediments, it becomes a gaseous form that's available for organisms to use. And some microorganisms can then take this methane, along with sulfate, to make energy. And the microorganisms work together in a way. So what becomes the waste product of one group of microorganisms becomes the energy source for another. This is similar to plants. Oxygen is actually the waste product of plant metabolism, and you and I need it to breathe. And so you get very specialized microorganisms that are found in these methane seeps that cannot live anywhere else. Now, animals have adapted strategies to live in these environments. Things like clams and mussels and even tube worms live in these environments by eating or living in association, we call symbiotic associations, with these microorganisms for their energy. And so in these environments, bacteria and chemicals form the base of the food web. Bacteria being similar to the plants that make the energy, and chemicals providing the energy similar to sunlight. And so what this creates is a very unique environment that's fascinating to explore. But they're hard to study because they're on the bottom of the ocean, they're difficult to find, and very difficult to access. But they're incredibly important to study for many reasons. For first, methane is actually a greenhouse gas. So understanding the geology and the biological organisms that influence how much methane gets up into our water column and eventually our atmosphere is very important. Methane in its hydrate form, which is a solid ice-like structure form, can actually be a potential energy source. So understanding how this methane is distributed below our below the sediments and what potential this has for energy is important. These chemosynthetic environments have the potential to influence the surrounding deep sea. For example, the Chilean sea bass is a fishery. These fish are dependent on methane seeps for both habitat and food. And if we're going to start using these deep sea environments, either for fisheries or energy sources, we may start to destroy organisms we have yet to discover. So in terms of a conservation standpoint, exploring for new species is very important. And lastly, as I mentioned, you have very specialized microorganisms that have many unique metabolisms in this environment. And this provides us insight into the capabilities of life both here on Earth and elsewhere, as well as potentially biomedically useful compounds like antibiotics. Okay, so now on to the fun part, how we went about finding our local seep. We were lucky to be funded through the UC Ship Funds program. This is a program offered to several of the UCs, including UCSD, that provides postdocs and graduate students at-sea experience, hands-on research training, and the opportunity to participate in collaborative research projects. So our SEEPS team was actually part of a larger cruise effort that you can see here through the track lines off our coast that covered a lot of ground and did a lot of really neat science. So today, though, I'm going to be focusing on our discovery of a methane SEEP right here off the coast, about 20 miles off the coast of San Diego, Del Mar, and Oceanside. Now back to those hints. We had some good hints from the U.S. Geological Survey that this region had seafloor features that were indicating that there may be gas seepage in this area. So we decided to head out and take a closer look. One of the easiest ways to explore a large spatial extent of the seafloor is to use sound. And so we use an instrument called an echo sounder mounted on the bottom of the ship that sends sound beams down to the seafloor and provides us information about the seafloor using different sound frequencies. So we can learn about the topography of the seafloor, what it looks like on the surface, as well as even the subsurface sediment structure, so we can look into the sediments to tell us something about what's going on. So this is actually a picture from the mound we discovered our methane seep at. Our methane seep was a little over 1,000 meters below the seafloor, so that's 3,000 feet. This mound is about the size, about 300 meters, so about the size of a city block and the height of about a two-story building. And this mound, along with these pock marks, are features that suggest to us that there's some sort of gas disruption in this area. The subsurface structure provides more evidence that this is a seep. This is depth into the sediments. So what you're looking at here is the layering of the sediments below the seafloor. And if you can see, you have sediment layering here, and this disruptive layer here. This indicates that there was a gas disruption in this area, wiping out that sediment structure. So both of these pieces of evidence suggested to us that we had found a methane seep. But in order to confirm this, we needed to sample the seafloor. We did this by sending a very large instrument called a multicore, which is about the height of two of me, down to the seafloor to bring back mud. So it brings back tubes of mud. We then can slice this mud on deck and start to look into the mud for evidence of methane seeps. What you can see here is these black areas in the mud. These are actually areas of sulfide granules. So this is a hydrogen sulfide. It's that rotten egg smell, and these cores did smell, which we were all super excited about. And these are actually produced by the microorganisms in low oxygen sediments typically found at seeps. And we were all on deck sniffing the mud as it came up. But in order to confirm that there were animals that were living in this environment, we would need to take a closer look. So we bring a lot of microscopes to see. And we take that mud and we look at it under different magnifications. And this is actually what that mud starts to look like. Large sand grains, particles, and fragments of shells. And living in this are tiny little creatures. And you can imagine how fun this is, picking out creatures with tweezers under high magnification on a moving ship. But after hours of sorting through the mud, we found evidence of a methane seep. Many of the organisms we found are characteristic of other seeps around the world. We found filamentous bacteria. These are bacteria that form thick mats on the top of methane seeps. We found animals. We found these vesicomyid clams, as well as siboglinid tomb worms. Both of these animals are found at other seeps around the world and have strategies living symbiotically with bacteria for their energy. We also found these tiny carbonate nodules. These are little calcium carbonate rocks that are actually produced by the microbes. They're precipitated by those bacteria as they use the methane. So together, along with all the animals we found, the microorganisms, as well as the geological evidence, had told us we'd found a methane seep. So upon our return to Scripps, they sent out a press release, and we got to have some fun in the media. The Union Tribune, along with NBC, Fox, KPBS, picked up our story, and it was really exciting for us to get to tell about our discovery. But I think for us, one of the most exciting things is what this means for deep sea research here at Scripps. In terms of our short-term science goals, we're going to be taking a closer look at the animals we brought back. So we'll be looking at their DNA to tell us something about how the animals we found are related to other animals found at similar seeps. We'll be using isotopes to understand something about how these organisms are using that methane and playing a role in these food webs. We hope after our second cruise in December to produce a paper on an initial characterization of the geology and biology of our particular seep habitat. And we're also exploring for ways to get photos and videos of our seep because we haven't seen it yet. In terms of the long-term implications and research potential for Scripps, it's very rare to have a chemosynthetic habitat like this so close to an oceanographic institution. And so this puts Scripps in a very unique place to study these types of environments over time. So it gives us the opportunity to maybe address some of these unanswered questions about the role of methane seeps in releasing this greenhouse gas, discover some new species, as well as explore for biomedically important compounds. It also provides the opportunity to forge new collaborations here at Scripps. I didn't mention this, but our particular seep is located along a fault line. So working together among geologists, chemists, and biologists, and understanding all of the controls on the release of methane into our oceans could provide a new potential collaboration. So with that, I would like to say thank you, certainly to the UC Ship Funds for giving a large group of students some ship time and some fun at sea, the RV Melville, our captain and crew, for all of their efforts to make our science happen, our chief scientist, Christina Frieder, who is also a graduate student here at Scripps and our fearless leader, my fellow SEEP team members, Jillian Maloney and Benjamin Gruppi, are both in the audience today, and this would not have been possible without them, as well as Valerie and Rachel, who were at sea with us. And of course, thank you to all of you for your continued support of Scripps and our research effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexis. Our next speaker is Julia Brown. Julia is vice chairman of the Scripps Director's Cabinet, trustee, UCSD Foundation, and advisor to the CEO, Amylin Pharmaceuticals. She participated as a research volunteer aboard the Roger Revelle research vessel on the exciting voyage to the Tonga Trench. Julia?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Yes, I'm Julia Brown, and I'm Vice Chair of the Director's Cabinet here at SIO. And my job this evening is to introduce Doug Bartlett, who is really your next speaker. Doug Bartlett has extensive experience in studying the nature of microbial life in some of the most remote regions of the world. These trenches are like the final frontier of the planet. Some people say that we actually know more about the moon than we know about the trenches, and Dr. Bartlett and his lab are among those who are studying them. A great biological diversity exists there, but we know very little about it. Only a tiny fraction of the species that live there have been identified. Dr. Bartlett's research group has pioneered some of the genetic studies of these organisms that have helped to identify the genes that allow organisms to flourish under that tremendous hydrostatic pressure, and the genes that are actually regulated by thousands of pounds of pressure per square inch. The Tonga Trench trip, which I just mentioned, was a student-led expedition, and Rosa, who you'll hear from in a few minutes, a PhD candidate in Dr. Bartlett's lab, was the chief scientist for that trip. But Dr. Bartlett himself was the chief scientist for James Cameron's trip a few months ago to the Marianas Trench, and he's here tonight to tell us more about that. Dr. Bartlett?
Thank you, Julia. You and Aaron and Craig would be welcome to come out to see any time, and that applies to the rest of you. If the opportunity is there, it'd be great to go to see with all of you. We may need a bigger ship than the Revelle, but it'd be great for you to have that experience. So let me back up a little bit before I tell you about the James Cameron expedition. There was this wonderful movie, The Abyss, produced 33 years ago. The Abyss had this wonderful protagonist, Bud Brigman, who drank this awful fluid so that he could withstand high pressure. He dropped down into the abyss. He inactivated a nuclear weapon. He announced touchdown when he hit the bottom. And then he was saved by aliens, and everything ended really well. So a great, great movie. Well, the person who wrote this wonderful script, including that touchdown moment, 33 years later, had his own touchdown moment, and it was real. It was the deepest spot on Earth, and he didn't have to drink that awful fluid to get there. So that's what I want to tell you a little bit about in the few minutes that I have, the James Cameron expedition, where I was the chief scientist. I was there for both legs of the expedition. We started off the island of New Britain in Papua New Guinea. So here's Australia, here's the New Britain Trench, here's the island of New Britain. So we started operations testing the sub and other equipment in the New Britain Trench, and then the expedition moved across the equator in western Micronesia in the area of Yap, beautiful atoll, the Ulithi Atoll, where the U.S. 7th Fleet maintained itself during World War II. And so that was our base of operations for going on to the Challenger Deep, the deepest location of any trench on Earth. Okay, so that's what we did, and this is how James did it, this incredible submersible. As you can see, just looking at these images of the submersible, it had a very unusual configuration, going vertical instead of horizontal. And it was this mean green machine. And it could rocket down at about 2 meters, almost 2 meters per second, rotating as it went down. And it went up almost twice that, almost 4 meters per second. So super fast, special type of syntactic foam for buoyancy. The hard part isn't going down. The hard part's coming back up. So that syntactic foam was really important. It also had beautiful LED lights. It had pressure-compensated lithium-ion batteries in it, and a variety of cameras, as you might imagine, for an expedition like that. So Here you see a view of a manipulator arm. On that manipulator arm, there was a macro lens and a wide-angle lens. Off of this boom arm here, there was a 3D video camera. Inside the sphere, looking through that porthole, Jim never looked through the porthole. It was just the camera looking through it. There was an Epic camera, the sort of camera that's used for IMAX filming was there. And there's also interior filming going on. So magnificent filming was a part of this as well. This is what it looked like inside. I want you to pay attention to the fact that Jim has his legs crossed. The sphere inside was only 43 centimeters in diameter, and you see it's just chock full of electronics and life support gear. So it was pretty cramped, and he had to have his legs cramped for the full time. So that's 7-8 hours or so to have your legs cramped. So imagine what that must have been like. I certainly wouldn't have done that. And as I've told others, the steel in that cylinder that housed Jim was nothing like the steel in Jim himself. To go in something like this, to hear those compression sounds for the better part of 7 miles going down and to hang in there, I would have begged it a long time, probably in the top couple hundred meters. So you can't say enough about what he did. Kathy mentioned the Bathyscaphe Trieste. So naturally, there were some comparisons made with the Bathyscaphe Trieste and the Deep Sea Challenger submersible. The folks who went in the Bathyscaphe Trieste, Jacques Picard, a Swiss engineer and oceanographer, and U.S. Navy Lieutenant Don Walsh, and then, of course, in Deep Challenger, it was Jim Cameron. Three people, far fewer than have walked on the moon. So again, as Kathy mentioned, this is a truly remote part of our planet that has been very infrequently examined. The Trieste was much larger. It really basically just went down, dropped its ballast, and came back up. There was a few minutes on the seafloor to look around, but that was it. Deep Challenger, much lighter, single pilot, went down and back very fast. Lots of great filming, many hours on the bottom. There were 11 different dives of the submersible during the expedition, most of those in the New Britain Trench, but also in the Challenger Deep and the area around Micronesia. This was the support ship, the Mermaid Sapphire, an oil survey vessel. So the crew associated with the sub, the team of engineers, were based on this vessel. The engineers, I just can't say enough about them. It was wonderful to see these people in action. It was a group of American engineers, many from the film industry, and Australian engineers working together. In fact, it was an interesting international expedition because a lot of the technical crew on the Mermaid Sapphire were from Scotland, so we had all different versions of the English language being presented during the trip. But the engineers worked tirelessly. In between every launch and recovery of the sub, there was invariably lots of work to be done. Seawater incursion into the hydraulics, some issues with the syntactic foam, some issues with changing out batteries and lights and so on. So lots of work for those guys, and they just did a miraculous job. In addition to using the lander, the sub, we also used landers. Here's a view of a lander above water and below water. So this was a wonderful tool. It had film capability. We could do 3D filming. We could do high-definition stills. It had lights. It had batteries. It had good communication, acoustics underwater, above water with GPS and radio and lights and so on. So a nice instrument. We used traps with it so we could attract animals, and the sub could then come to the landers to see some of those animals. So things got started off of the island of New Britain, out of the city of Rabaul, still a great place to get betel nuts if you like that sort of thing. And if you go to any of the farmers markets here, I can tell you that the people on the island of New Britain really like betel nuts. I want to show you this image. This was a great shipping port at one time. In the 1990s, there was a volcanic eruption. Tverver, here you see in the distance, blew its top, destroyed much of the city. And its role in shipping was dramatically reduced afterwards. Still a major ash layer. And this brings up the the impact that trenches have on our life, on earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, because these are the places where Earth's surface, its crust, goes to be recycled, and that results in seismic disturbance, and you see the manifestations of that and this sort of thing. Okay, well, we always had another ship associated with the expedition. In Papua New Guinea, it was a dive boat, the Spirit of New Guinea, wonderful Papua New Guinean crew there. And in Micronesia, we had a crew from Indonesia on another oil survey vessel that accompanied with us. So I worked out of this ship along with some other folks, and the daily commute was just fantastic, much better than we have here in San Diego. To be out in the Solomon Sea, not just in the morning, but in the evenings, in the middle of the night, fantastic. I just can't tell you what the stars look like at night in a place like that. So oftentimes we'd get onto the Mermaid Sapphire early in the morning. There'd be a meeting on the bridge. The people we'd first see on the bridge would be the film crew, and they were ever present. A very friendly group of people, very large group of people, because they had to carry the 3D cameras, which are very heavy. Usually they're on tracks, and so took a lot of weight and took a lot of effort. And these guys, even on containers, were carrying these things and filming sub-launches and whatnot, and really worked hard. Wonderful group of people. This is John Bruno, an Academy Award-winning film director who is there. Just a great group of people to talk to. And here's another great person. Jim was there during all of these meetings on the bridge to go through the day's events and to go through the state of the sub. So for every sub team involved with the engineering, he would go through with them where things were at, where were the problems, what needed to be solved, when would it be solved. You needed to have answers. It wasn't acceptable in an expedition like this to say that you weren't sure when something would be up and operational. You had to say when something was going to be up and operational, or there had to be a backup plan. And it was really inspirational to see Jim, the son of an engineer, taking the engineering teams through this session of trying to find out where everything was at so that a plan could be developed. Very decisive. You know, here, working in a university environment where we have so many committees, it was very refreshing to be out at sea, where that was the one guy making decisions, and he made them right then and there. So things worked really quickly. So the most exciting part of this expedition for me was a few days into the expedition when the sub first got launched, and we first got to see it in action. So it's not going super deep here, but here it is getting launched off the starboard of the Mermaid Sapphire. Here it is getting recovered, and this is not a very good image at all, but this guy here just worked heroically during the expedition. Charlie Arneson, a former student here at Scripps, now runs film operations. In fact, he was involved with the filming of the movie Titanic in Rosarito Beach. Just a wonderful scientist and logistics expert, and you name it. Great Scripps connection. So here's the sub getting recovered, and here's Jim looking very, very refreshed coming out of that sub, looking remarkably good. We had some temperature problems, so it got up to more than 90 degrees Fahrenheit during some of the dives, and I don't know how he was able to come out looking as good. He was certainly very excited that first dive. In fact, every dive, he was very pumped up when he would come out of the submersible. After his interviews, he would go right to editing film. And I just took this picture with my little 35 millimeter. A bunch of us associated with the expedition were in another room. So Jim's editing film. He's got a split screen. He's looking at various images. And this is for the first time we're seeing what the operation looks like down fairly deep. This is about a kilometer down. These are some images taken by a remote-operated vehicle. And you can see on the left the sub coming over here in its vertical configuration, coming right up to this lander here that's on the sea floor. Here's the arm that's dropped down. It's got some baited traps over there. What an image. You see a little bit of a close-up view on the right. It really hit home to all of us that there was something really special that these engineers had come up with and that Jim was directing and operating. So what did the sub see? Here you see a 3D camera looking back at that epic camera. You see a jelly. There were a series of dives in the New Britain Trench going down to more than 8 kilometers, setting by far a new deep diving record for a manned submersible, not like a bathyscaphe, but a submersible that can move along the sea floor. So it was remarkable to see the film footage. We have many terabytes of video data from this expedition. Jim, with that macro lens, here he is moving right up along the New Britain Trench, filming these beautiful stalk sea anemones, and he could just come right up close to these beautiful flower-like organisms and capture some of their close-up detail. So a lot of just beautiful filming. The landers did filming as well, sometimes of the submersible. This is fairly shallow water, you can tell, because of the conger eels. They wouldn't be found so deep. But the lander was also able to film the submersible close-up and do a lot of other filming as well. This was a surprising view here. This is a still image from the lander looking at the deepest example of gigantism yet seen. These are amphipod crustaceans, usually the size of the last digit on your thumb, but in this case, they're the size of your feet, perhaps. They're 17 to 30 centimeters in length, so really large beasts and really unexpected. And here are just some of the close-up images of those guys. We attracted them with chicken, and you can see what happened to the chicken after it was on the seafloor for a little while. These guys are just amazing scavengers. I think we really could have put pretty much any carcass down there, and this would have happened. So, Scripps has a long history in some of this kind of thing, not in a sub like the Deep Challenger, but in doing lander operations. And I just want to pay homage to some of the work that's gone on before. John Isaac with his deep sea camera system that he had developed, Bob Hessler with the work he had done for many years collecting these crustaceans with baited traps and then characterizing their taxonomy and behavior and life history and so on, and others who looked at the microbes inside them and used them as a way to look at the adaptations of deep microbial life to deep sea conditions, Art Yoyano. So this is just the perfect place to be thinking about deep sea life. We moved on from the New Britain Trench to the Challenger Deep, and I just want to highlight how deep means in this case. So you see in this graphic how high Denver is and the Matterhorn and Mount Everest. And then you see how deep the Challenger Deep is. It's deeper than all of those mountains are high. Those locations are high. It's deeper than commercial airlines fly. It's certainly deeper than the Titanic's resting spot or where manned submersibles go and so on. So 36,000 plus feet, almost 7 miles down, almost 11,000 meters. So I want you to listen to this. So this is that deep dive. So this is Jim descending onto the floor of the Challenger Deep.
Touchdown. Woo.
See? The second touchdown. There's some acoustic communication with the bridge. It's not very clear. I apologize. So that's the bridge asking what's up.
Surface, this is Deep Sea Challenger. I am on the bottom. Depth is 35,756 feet. And life support's good. Everything looks good.
Okay, so that was the deepest drop. After that, Jim made it back up to the surface. The co-founder of Microsoft, Paul Allen, whisked him away on his mega yacht, and he went off to the premiere of Titanic 3D. That was largely the end of the sub-operations, but I do want to highlight that during that dive, that last deepest dive, there was some science sampling going on. There's a lot of video that was done, but also Jim was able to get a sediment sample. Not as much as Julie and Aaron and Craig and I and others on the Tonga Trench were able to process, but still he got a little bit of sediment here, and that was a great thing. I'll also highlight for you all that there's a watch on this manipulator arm. It's a Rolex watch that's been specially engineered to withstand 15,000 pounds per square inch of pressure. So if you ever want a watch like that, you know where to go. This is one of the last drops of the lander. So I showed you the last sub dive. This is one of the last lander drops. You see the baited arm crashing down on the sea floor. This was really useful to us. It crashes on the sea floor. It kicks up all this sediment, which goes into the trap, this water sampler that we have. We're able to collect some microbial mat material and begin processing it. In the distance, there are some rocks, some beautiful blue rocks, the result of a mineralogical process known as serpentinization that produces hydrogen gas. And so we're really interested to see, are we getting any hydrogen utilizing microbes from some of these samples, as some of our geologist friends suggest might exist. Okay, well, I'm out of time for what I have to say. I certainly want to thank Jim and all those engineers that were part of Deep Sea Challenge, just an incredible group of people. Wish you could get a chance to meet all of them. The movie's coming out in early 2013, so stay tuned for that. And I want to then switch gears a little bit. I want to move on to a distinguished colleague of mine who has some words to share with you about deep sea animal exploration. So let's move on to Professor Greg Rouse. He couldn't be here tonight, but he's certainly here in spirit and now in video.
Hello, my name's Greg Rouse. I'm a professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. What I'd like to share with you is some amazing imagery and videos of deep sea animals that collaborators and I have gathered over the last decade.
My primary research interest in the deep sea is to look at the animal diversity that's down there. And this really leads us to the question of how many species are in the deep sea. And it's extraordinary that we really have no idea. There are estimates that are ranging across orders of magnitude. Very little of this diversity has actually even been named. That's my mission, is to find this biodiversity and to then name them. And when we get down into the deep sea, any habitat that's below 200 meters, you might have it in your mind that it's basically a big muddy plain that extends across the ocean floor. But it's not like that at all. While admittedly most of it is a vast abyssal plain at about 4,000 meters in depth, there are many other kinds of habitats down there. There are seamounts, there are deep sea coral reefs, there are amazing canyons, there are sponge reefs. And personally, the ones that I find most fascinating are places like hydrothermal vents and methane seeps and whale falls when animals fall and their bodies end up down in the deep sea. So I'll just run through a few of these different habitats and some of the research we've been doing down there. And firstly, these hydrothermal vents are places usually located near volcanic activity in the deep sea. Very hot seawater ends up spewing out of the ocean crust. And this is often full of chemicals such as hydrogen sulfide, which can then drive bacterial communities, which in turn then lead to great animal diversity and biomass. So this is beyond the realm of the sun, and yet we have many, many species of animals living down there, thriving off bacterial communities. And here you can see one, an extraordinary one, called a vestimentiferan tube worm. It's in the genus Oasisia, and it's off hydrothermal vents near Easter Island in the South Pacific. This Oasisia species is new. It's probably the last of the vestimentiferan tube worms. This is one that is actually available through the Scripps Name a Species program. You can sponsor the Scripps collections and you'll have a species named for you. Another place we've been studying in detail, and this is in collaboration with Lisa Levin, another professor here at Scripps, are methane seeps. And these are similar to hydrothermal vents in that they support huge bacterial communities and then in turn animal communities. And it's based more though on methane and hydrogen sulfide that are coming up through areas near petroleum deposits or other terrestrial organic debris that's ended up down in the deep sea and then creates this other chemical ecosystems that support life. So we've been exploring these off Costa Rica and Oregon in the last few years. And here you can see on the video that there's large numbers of mussels and clams and giant tube worm clumps that are all being supported by these bacteria. But the one I want to highlight is this amazing crab, the Yeti crab. Here you can see a bunch of Yeti crabs dancing. They're waving their arms backwards and forwards, and it's actually in flow of sulfide and methane. Why are they doing this? Well, this species was named by Andrew Thurber, a recent Scripps graduate, and he called it Kiwa Puravida. And what they're doing is they're waving their hairy arms in the methane sulfide flow to grow bacteria on those arms, and they're then licking the bacteria off their arms. So they're basically farming bacteria to eat. When kiwa were first described a few years ago from the East Pacific, they were thought of as predators, and it was only because we were able to get down there with a submersible and look at them up close and alive that we were able to figure out that this dancing behavior was first seen and then figured out based on the idea that they were harvesting these bacteria. So they're not carnivores at all, they're just bacterivores, but we wouldn't have found that out without submersibles. Where I've spent most of my research time, though, apart from methane seeps and hydrothermal vents, has actually been looking at whale carcasses. When whales die, they float for a while on the surface, and sometimes they get washed up, but generally they fall down to the bottom, and then their flesh is stripped off by sharks, sleeper sharks, and hagfish. They end up then as a vast amount of bones lying on the bottom. Now, these bones actually support extraordinary communities of animals as well, similar to what we find at hydrothermal vents and methane seeps. What was extraordinary, though, is that Monterey Bay Aquarium and Research Institute, people who I work with quite closely, found a whale carcass up in Monterey in 2002. They saw that the whale bones were covered with this amazing red carpet. It literally covered the bones, as you can see in this video here. The red carpet turned out to be an animal. Hundreds and hundreds of these amazing worms are actually drilling into the bone and dissolving the bone. And they're closely related to those hydrothermal vent worms that I showed you called Oasisia. Like Oasisia, they're living off bacteria. The symbiosis, the living together of these bone worms and bacteria, allows them to drill in and dissolve the bone, and then the bacteria and worms eat together the fat and collagen protein that are making up the bone. So we called these worms os, which means bone, and edax, devour. And these were only found in 2002, only 10 years ago, and now we found that there are 20 species of these worms so far known, and they're found in habitats all over the world in the deep sea, acting on bones wherever they're falling to the seafloor. The last habitat I want to talk about is the deep pelagic. In fact, the deep pelagic is the largest ecosystem in the world. It covers millions and millions of cubic miles. This is really the least explored habitat of the deep sea. One I want to highlight are these amazing worms we found a few years ago, which we initially called green bombers. So why do we call them this name? You can see the worms swimming in the video here, and if you go up close near their head, you see these little green orbs. It turns out that if the animals are disturbed, they shed these green orbs, these green bombs, and once they're shed, they actually begin to glow. They're bioluminescent. Of course, these animals are living down in very, very dark water. All of them have been found a mile or two deep, where it's pitch dark, but once they shed these green orbs, they would then glow and presumably distract their predators so that the worm could then swim away. So these animals had never been seen before 2007. We've now found that there are 7 different species. They had to be captured with submersible. If we try and capture them with a net, they end up usually being destroyed. Even trying to catch them with a submersible is a challenge, but when we do get them successfully into the funnel and then down into the chambers, they then come up in beautiful condition, as you can see in the photographs here, and then allow us to do the live study that let us realize that they were casting off these green bombs. So we now have 7 species of these worms, but they've only been studied off California and the Philippines. So who knows how many more of them are yet to be found down there, and who knows what other amazing animals are down in the deep sea. Thanks very much.
Okay, that is my distinguished colleague, Greg Rouse, who's also the current curator of the benthic invertebrates collection. So now it's time to hear from all of you and to get some questions. And we need the rest of the crew to come up here and sit down. So that would be Julia Brown, Michael Buckingham. Michael Buckingham is a distinguished professor, and he resides in the Marine Physical Lab and is an expert on deep ocean acoustics. You might have seen deep sound out in the forum. So, yeah, please have a seat in one of these stools. Rosa Leon Zayas. There you are, Rosa, chief scientist on the Tonga Trench Expedition. Lihini Alawahari, a dynamic deep-sea geochemist who's here. Ali, that you've heard of, Alexis Pasulka. So please come back. And Hiram Cha, am I saying that correctly? Hiram, great. From the aquarium, yes. From the collection. This is for you, Allie. Why do sea bass need methane seeps? Do they eat the bacteria?
A lot of it is habitat, so there's a lot of structure. So methane seeps, if you saw from those pictures, once those carbonate nodules get bigger and bigger and bigger and they get precipitated, they form sort of lots of rock areas. And so a lot of what the sea bass benefit from is the habitat, the structure to hide in, to live in. So a lot of that is habitat. As far as I know, the sea bass themselves do not actually eat the bacteria. They may be eating animals benefiting from some of the other animals eating the bacteria.
Oh, Mike, this is a question for you. What can you listen to in the deep sea?
anything, I suppose. Well, with our deep sound system, which some of you may have seen outside, we can listen to surface ships, which are fairly low frequency. Well, low frequency in our terms, a seismologist would say it's very high frequency. But surface ships are from about 10 hertz up to a kilohertz or so. But the system goes up to as high as 30 kilohertz. So we can hear anything from 10 hertz up to 30 kilohertz. Well, at the higher frequencies, most of the sound comes from the sea surface, and in that case, it's breaking waves. A wave, when it rolls over and breaks, it creates a lot of bubbles. And each bubble, when it is formed, it rings like a bell. Basically, when it's formed, it's out of equilibrium with the environment. And so let's say it's under a high pressure, or there's a high pressure inside the bubble. So when it's formed, that pressure forces the bubble out. It goes past its equilibrium radius and beyond, stops moving, and then it's still out of equilibrium. It's now under pressurized, and so it starts to collapse, and it just keeps oscillating backwards and forwards. This is a really good sound source. Well, sea surface waves are producing billions of bubbles all the time. And so the waves are one of the major sources of sound that we hear with our system at these higher frequencies. And just recently, in 2009, our deep sound system, it was the first time we deployed it, and it went down to 6 kilometers deep on that occasion. Since then, it's been down to 9 kilometers. But we heard the sea surface fairly clearly. The sea surface sound fairly clearly from essentially zero depth right down to 6 kilometers. And the intensity of the sound didn't change. So we were hearing surface waves very clearly at 6 kilometers deep. So the intensity didn't change very much. With a system that we have, we can hear not just the intensity, but we can tell the directionality of the sound as well. And one of the things that we found on that occasion was that, and in that location, was that most of the sound was downward traveling, and there was nothing coming upwards. Well, that sort of makes sense if you think that the sound's coming from the surface. You'd expect a lot of it to be coming downward. But on the other hand, there is a bottom down there, and you'd expect some reflections coming off the bottom, and there were essentially none. And our interpretation of that was that the bottom in these deep ocean locations very often is a very, very soft sediment. And I think we saw some pictures of that type of sediment earlier on. When a lander hits it, you see the sort of powder puff effect of very fine particles of sediment just blown up by the lander. And that's a very poor acoustic reflector. And so what's essentially happening with the sea surface sound is it's going down, hitting the bottom, and just being absorbed by it, and very little of it's been reflected. So I suppose the bottom line is here that with our deep sound system, we can use the natural sound that we hear to infer information about the environment, particularly in this case, the seabed. We're using it, in effect, like an echo sounder. And I think Alexis mentioned an echo sounder earlier on, and you could see the structure of the seabed when you send a ping down. You get multiple reflections from the stratification. Well, we can do the same sort of thing with natural sound with our deep sound system, except in the Philippine Sea, there was no stratification and no reflection from the bottom. But that's what we found.
Maybe a question for you, Professor Alawahari, and that is, when you do your sampling with your special pump, you collect sometimes thousands of liters of water. Why do you need to collect so much water, and what are the questions? What do you do with all that water, or everything you filter from the water?
Well, I do whatever's my fancy, but perhaps what's most... we recently published, not that recently actually, a study that allowed... Alexis talked about chemosynthetic communities, and when you look at hydrothermal vents, for example... as chemists, we just look at the chemical compounds and we say, oh, yeah, there's so much energy stored in those chemical compounds. And, of course, that energy must be available for biological production. But in the deep ocean that we were talking about, where there are no hydrothermal vents, which is most of the deep ocean, it's not obvious that you have chemical sources of energy that could support chemosynthetic communities. And we were able to use our pumps, similar types of pumps, to filter really large quantities of seawater to about 50,000 to 200,000 liters. And we isolate microbes. We take their DNA out. And like most people, we look at what the community composition looks like. But we can also measure their isotope composition when we have that much volume. And I won't get into the details of the isotopes, but by looking at the isotope composition, we can tell something about what they're eating. So in most of the deep ocean, communities really rely, even at 9,000 meters, what's being made at the surface by photosynthetic organisms are integral to the communities that live at depth. But what we were able to show is that a significant fraction of the community that lives in the deep ocean is also chemosynthetic in the absence of these obvious sources of chemical energy. And we would never have been able to do that without isotopes. The genes suggest that the capability is there, but you couldn't have quantified the amount of chemosynthesis that was going on by just looking at the genes. So a lot of the work that I do is really aimed at using these geochemical tools, isotopes, to tell you about the biological processes, but also the sources of the different elements that support life in sort of the more general deep ocean, not these specialized environments, but most of what the planet is.
There's a couple questions. Again, this I think may be one for you, Allie. How many seeps worldwide? Seeps worldwide? That's going to be hard to quantify that.
There's a lovely map I probably should have shown. But I think known there's about 100 to 130. So these are constantly being discovered simply because it's difficult to get a ship to go explore the seafloor the way we did. But a lot of them mostly are focused along the edges of continents. So we know about 130, but there are probably many, many more. Oh, it's not any harder to study than the rest of the deep sea. It's just difficult to get access to the deep sea in terms of getting submersibles and samples. So,
yeah, so why is it more difficult for the submersible itself to come up rather than to go down? So when I made that comment, it's simply that it's not difficult to add ballast to something so that it's negatively buoyant and it will sink down to full ocean depth. The hard part is having that instrument or that submersible, if you will, be intact all the way to the seafloor and to be in a position where it can release its weights and then float up to the top. Having buoyancy, it's easy to add weights. Having floats that will stay intact at great depth is a bit of a problem because floats can implode. At one time in deep ocean work, people actually used gasoline for buoyancy, and that wasn't actually such a risk except for the fact that it's gasoline and it's a toxic chemical and hazardous chemical. But now for a lot of buoyancy, we use glass floats or ceramic floats, and those are a little bit more fragile, and they can implode sometimes with wear and with pressure and depth. So there's a risk associated with that. It's hard to come up with syntactic foam. That's another material that can be used. It's hard to come up with syntactic foam that will stay buoyant even at great depth and pressure. So those are some of the reasons. Hiram, we haven't heard from you yet, and I don't know if the folks here have had a chance to hear very much about the collections. It might be useful for you to say a little bit about what you do and how the samples come to you.
Hello, nice to meet you. And my name is Harim, and I'm a collection manager and also scientist working for the benthic invertebrate collection. And I'm representing here for the Scripps oceanographic collections. And we have three biological collections and one geological collection. It covers rock and mineral collection. And Scripps collections started when Scripps actually started. So we have the same history, like more 103 years of history, and we are archiving all the materials that generated from the research project that's been done in SIO. So we are great resource for a lot of international researchers. So that is, you know, available for teaching and research. Also, the materials that is available for outreach. So biological collections, we have vertebrate collection, which covers fish, of course, in marine system. And we have a pelagic invertebrate collection, and we have a benthic invertebrate collection. And all biological collections have the same mission, supporting research, supporting education, and outreach. So thank you for being here. Thank you for your support. And thank you.
Thanks, Harold. Okay, maybe one last question for you, Rosa. Rosa is a graduate student in my laboratory, and so I know you know a lot about the deep sea, and we just got a question. This is a little bit afield, but I think you'll handle it well. Was there any evidence of plastic residue found at the bottom of the ocean or trenches studied by scientists at SIO in sea life or otherwise on the seafloor? I think I've got that right.
In terms of plastic in the ocean or in the bottom of the ocean, there's certainly a lot of plastic. And there's a student-led cruise that came out of here to study plastic in the Pacific Ocean, the surface ocean. They found that there was a lot of plastic out there, and the organisms are working with the plastic and struggling in the plastic at the same time. So using it as a resource for substrate, but also being, you know, having to use it as a substrate in some cases being harmful to them. But in case of the bottom of the ocean, I've never seen really plastic come out of the bottom of the ocean. Every time that we go out there, we do put a lot of things in the bottom of the ocean because we have sent all these instruments with weights, and we leave the weights out there. And I like thinking that it becomes a substrate for organisms to be able to live on. That gives me a peace of mind. You know, it's great. But in terms of plastic, I'm not sure we've seen a lot of plastic. Also, in the deep trenches, it's really hard to sample large amounts of space. So every time that we go out there, we bring our bottles, like you saw, and it takes water from this very specific location. And if we go sample sediment samples, it's a very specific location. So it's very hard to get a sense of all the things that are out there. I do know that from the Challenger Deep, some of the video that came out, there were some things on the floor, but it was more like metal left out by something. So, but in terms of plastic, I'm not really very sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Rosa. I do know that from colleagues in Japan, they've done filming in the Japan Trench, so fairly close to a concentrated area of human population. And there's a variety of refuse way down, even 7 kilometers or so in the Japan Trench. You can see all sorts of appliances, shoes. The most eerie video that I ever saw of the deep sea environment was a video in the Japan Trench that showed a mannequin. And to see a mannequin in the seafloor was surreal. And the scientists would go back every year to see how far the sediment had gone up the mannequin. And there are people interested in plastic degrading microbes from the Japan Trench, so there's some work there. So, yeah, the plastic that concentrates in the ocean gyres does make its way into the deep ocean. So that's a great question.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.